Andy Burnham, and you're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. This week, Project Galaxy is announced. But what the hell is it? Two ILR stations in the red, a look at the latest issue of the underground radio magazine, The Wave, the BRDJ on Caroline, how the DCC mini-disc battle may lie in the hands of the computer industry, acoustic design of radio control rooms, affordable video conferencing and its unglamorous partner audio conferencing, cell phones hit the high street, plus lots of up-to-date radio news and your letters. This is Sparks for Monday and Tuesday on Radio Facts 3910, 6205 and 12255.
Now you found the light. You, that child, that one's lost, the child before the grave. report in the Financial Times. Chiltern Radio in the red to the tune of £179,000. Chiltern Radio has reported a reduced pre-tax loss of £179,000, bearing out its warning that it would be unable to break even in its seasonally difficult first half. The deficit in the comparable period was £234,000, but for the whole of 1990-91 the result was a profit of £114,000. Sales in the first half of the year to March the 31st rose to £2.55 million, but the comparable figure included only 3 months' contribution from newly acquired stations Galaxy Radio and Seven Sound. Losses per share declined to 1.9p. The company has focused its efforts on attracting advertising from smaller companies and has seen evidence of an improvement in sales. It will also continue its efforts to gain another license. The directors have decided that it would not be prudent to pay an interim dividend. Chiltern Radio's financial results reported in the Financial Times.
Down south a bit now to that exciting part of the world, Slough. Michael Cavanagh reports in broadcast that TriStar Broadcasting, led by former managing director of County Sound, Mike Powell, has won the most hotly contested radio licence advertised by the Radio Authority to date. TriStar beat off 8 other groups to win the Windsor, Slough and Maidenhead licence, following a meeting of the Radio Authority last week. The licence will serve a population of around 400,000 in an area west of London that's already served by 18 other stations. At the same time, the authority awarded the Colchester licence to Colchester FM, which will operate as a subsidiary of Norwich-based East Anglian Radio. The application, led by their managing director Russell Stewart, expands geographical coverage of the East Anglia Radio Group at a time when there is speculation about the chances of a merger between the group and neighbouring Mid Anglia Radio. The victory of TriStar in the Windsor, Slough and Maidenhead contest means the demise of other bids, including Castle FM, chaired by chat show host Terry Wogan. Not anymore. The victory has also been followed by the closure of rival bidder WSM Radio, which until last weekend ran a permanent radio service via local cable TV operator Windsor Cable. The group was the first to congratulate the victors last Thursday, while at the same time abandoning its service, which has been operating for 2.5 years. Tim Halfhead, director of TriStar and former managing director of Windsor Cable Television, said he believed the group's in-depth research into its application was the overriding factor in the company's success. The station, with the planned on-air name of Star FM, plans to concentrate on local news and information and pitch its music output at an older audience. Limited Asian programming is planned to serve a large Asian population to the east of its coverage area. We would like to go on air as soon as possible, but frequency problems mean we may have to delay the launch until spring, said Halfhead. Mike Powell, acting chief executive at Cornwall commercial station Pirate FM, which launched earlier this year, will be permanent managing director at this station. That's in broadcast.
Here's something in The Independent about the financial state of LBC. Crown slides further into the red. Crown Communications, the broadcasting company that owns the London news-based radio station LBC, has dropped further into loss for the first 6 months to the 31st of March. Crown lost £5.6 million in the interim period against £4.7 million last year. Christopher Chataway, Crown's chairman, said the losses were unsustainable. He said the company was experiencing particular difficulties with RFM, its network of 89 radio stations in France. Mr. Chataway said it continues to be the critical problem. In September, Crown raised £4.8 million in a rights issue at 45 pence. 2 years ago, Crown shares were trading above 250 pence. Cash from the rights issue was used to reduce borrowings and increase working capital. Mr. Chataway said that RFM showed good signs of progress at that time, but recent audience surveys indicated that the promising signs had evaporated. Mr. Chataway said RFM can only survive if Crown finds a partner in the venture. He said Crown is also looking to protect its own situation, a hint that RFM may be sold. Despite the rights issue, Crown's interest payments in the six-month period were only 15% lower, at £1.1 million. Crown was also hit by losses of £1.6 million on the disposal of investments, including its stakes in the broadcasting concerns Marcher Sound, Allied Radio, Midlands Radio and Radio Trust. Mr. Chataway said the company's future lies with LBC. He reported that the London station lost £300,000 in the half year, but that was £1.5 million better than last year. The better performance was a result of a sharp increase in the station's advertising revenue, which rose by 26%. For the second year in succession, Crown has not paid a half-time dividend. Robert Cole, writing in The Independent.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax, and we look forward to receiving all your letters, the address being Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. And if you'd like a reply, then please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. However, you don't have to send anything and you can be read out on the air. The address again is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. And one such person is Anne Faust in Berlin in Germany. She says she collects QSL cards. Shortwave listening is my hobby. I like it very much. Please send your QSL card to me. You would make me very happy. For your postage, I enclose some British stamps. I've been in London last year for a weekend trip. This time I bought a few stamps. And she says, I heard your station for the first time when I tuned in to the 75-metre tropical band. That's Anne Faust. Thanks very much for your letter and report. And here's Dennis Kelleher, who's in Middleton, County Cork, in the Republic of Ireland. On the above frequencies, the signal was exactly the same. He's talking about 3910 and 6205. Your signal on 12255 was also very strong due to the fact there was unusual propagation about. The signal on my receiver peaked S9, averaging around 7 to 8. Under normal conditions, it would be impossible to receive the signal on 12255. My receiver is a Kenwood TS44ETS, and the antenna is a 102-foot-long centre-fed horizontal dipole. Thanks for that, Dennis, in County Cork in Ireland. And look out for the Spark stand at the Southend Radio Rally, which is on Sunday the 16th of August in Essex, Rochford, the Rochway Centre. Not exactly sure where that is. I'll have to find out for you because I got to get there myself as well. So it's the Rochway Centre, Rochford in Essex. And tables are very cheap. Inside it's £5 or £10 if you don't bring a table, and outside it's £5. And for booking, you can call John Stone, who's on 0702, which is Southend, 202216. 0702 202216. That's the Southend Radio Rally on Sunday, 16th of August. John D. Newnham has written in from Jarrow in Tyne and Wear, saying many thanks for the interesting programmes of late. 6205 has been very poor due to interference, and he's been tuning into 3910, much the same as I do. He encloses enclosed articles off the record. Yes, thanks, I did that a few weeks ago. And Rail News, a British Rail publication, which is quite extraordinary. So I'll just open this out, and we see a picture of the Ross Revenge with fairly up-to-date looking aerial system. And on the air, Chris Watford in tune with 275,000 listeners as he joins in the 28th birthday celebrations of Radio Caroline, normally operating as below, however, at the moment afloat in Dover Harbour. Chris Watford couldn't believe his luck when he was asked to broadcast on the infamous Radio Caroline. Manager of the former pirate, in quotes, station Peter Moore, on hearing recordings of Chris's spare time shows on other radio networks, asked him if he could broadcast to Europe to help celebrate Radio Caroline's 28th birthday. Although the station has been transmitting with a licence on low power from her ship in Dover Harbour, a special contract was signed for Caroline to additionally broadcast via the Astra satellite from luxury studios in Churchdown, Gloucestershire. Chris, Communications and Campaigns Manager to the Director of Safety at BR's Paddington HQ, accepted the extraterrestrial challenge like a rocket and presented a music-packed show to an estimated audience of 275,000 throughout the UK and Europe. That's over twice the number of employees on the whole of British Rail. The safety DJ told Rail News, "I didn't realise just how big my audience was until the satellite company Quality Europe FM told me." Enthusiastic responses came in from as far away as Oslo, Moscow and Lisbon, and the programme was also relayed on cable TV networks in Spain and on an FM radio station in Holland. It's amazing to think that a station can go into space and back again and be heard over such a wide area. But in spite of gaining a place with the stars in Caroline's broadcasting history portfolio, Chris wants to keep radio as a hobby and his career firmly on the rails. Well, tabloid style there for the British Rail House newspaper. It's a nice colour photo of the Ross Revenge. On the same page, lights out, Ely signal lamplighter Frank Groom has lit his last lamp. Thrilling stuff. And yes, Quality Europe FM's listening figures, they've got about as much chance of getting them right as we have as estimating our listening figures. Anyone got any guesses? Thanks very much for that, John Newnham, and thanks also for sending the Shortwave magazine cuttings in. I'm always happy to receive radio news, whether from straightforward sources or the most extraordinary, as with John's offerings. So whether you think I may have seen it or not, I'd be very grateful if you sent me your radio news and information from wherever it may be.
I saw you standing on the corner. You look so big and fine. I really wanted to go out with you. So when you smiled, I laid my heart on the line.
Try. You are there with your badge and rubber boots. I think
Cellnet to target family customers. Cellnet, the mobile phone operator, is to try to turn what the Chancellor Norman Lamont dubbed the scourge of modern life into the essential family accessory by slashing the price of portable phones and making them available through high street electrical retailers. The user-friendly package, which should be available later this year, could mean the average monthly cost of a mobile phone to a domestic customer will be about £30 a month, which is half the current bill for the average small business user. That will be done both by reducing the monthly subscription charges and by introducing a new charging structure with cheaper off-peak rates. Currently, it costs 33p a minute to phone in peak time within the M25, 25p in the rest of the country, and 10p a minute off-peak in both areas. Cellnet also hopes to stimulate demand by making the phones available, ready to use immediately in high street stores. Currently, purchasers have to find a service provider, pay a sizeable connection fee, and sign a contract, typically for a year or more. Under the new arrangements, Cellnet has set up its own service provider, which will be responsible for credit checking and billing retail customers. Cellnet's research suggests 1 million people would buy a mobile phone if the price were right. If this succeeds, mobile phones will be the consumer item of the 1990s, like personal stereos were for the 1980s, a spokesman claimed. The move is aimed partly at preempting competition from suppliers of rival PCN, personal communication networks, which will be allowed to market their services directly to the public. These were due to start operating at the beginning of 1993, but industry sources believe the timetable will be delayed. But Cellnet is also likely to be hoping that demand from retail users will compensate for a sluggish business market, where demand is slowing, both because of the recession and because of the large number of firms that are already connected. Cellnet accounts for 555,000 of the 1.25 million mobile phone users, with the remainder supplied by its rival, Vodafone. Heather Connon, City correspondent, writing in The Independent.
And in Germany, Grundig to shed 3,000 jobs. Christopher Parks reports. The German electronics group is to reduce its workforce by 3,000 because of a severe decline in the home entertainment market. Most of the job losses are expected to be incurred in Germany, where rising labour costs are hampering efforts to remain competitive in the face of overseas competition. The television factory and components works in Nuremberg and Fürth are likely to bear the brunt. At the end of last year, about 60% of the company's 21,000 workforce was employed in Germany. However, employment has been rising in subsidiaries in Portugal and Malaysia, where pay is lower. That was in the Financial Times. Thanks to Ron Prosser for sending that in.
In engineering information from the BBC, Bob Walker describes a new approach to control room acoustics based on controlled reflection zones. In the very earliest days of sound control rooms or cubicles, the acoustic designer attempted to mimic the final listening environment. Indeed, studies were carried out into typical living room conditions in order to obtain numerical values for the reverberation time. The values actually obtained were within the region 0.6 to 0.8 seconds. However, various arguments about increased accuracy of listening and more analytic conditions ensured that the design target for control rooms was somewhat lower, at about 0.3 to 0.4 seconds. That approach survived essentially until the advent of stereophony. Then, with the emphasis on exact and objectively accurate image localization, the disturbing effects of early reflections became apparent. Strong discrete reflections, in the period up to around 20 milliseconds after the arrival of the direct sound, caused distortion of the perceived sound stage and significant image shifts. Beginning in about the early or mid-1960s, acoustic treatment was applied selectively to control these reflections. The extent of this control appears to have increased progressively up to the present time. Unfortunately, the complete control of reflections in this way leads to very large total quantities of acoustic treatment and extremely dead rooms. Measured reverberation times of less than 0.15 second are now frequently encountered. If this could be interpreted statistically, which is not possible because the sound field is usually far from diffuse, it would correspond to a mean absorption coefficient for the whole room of about 60%. This large amount of acoustic treatment is very expensive in terms of capital cost, installation cost, and space within the room. It also leads to rooms which, for the occupants, are extremely oppressive. The tendency now is for image localization to be less technically exact. Many sources are panned into artificial locations, but to retain a high degree of apparent image definition. For most programs, the listener has no knowledge about the physical location of the sources, except for traditional orchestral music performances. Even then, the listener is unaware of the conceptual seat location. It is perhaps now even more important that the stereo illusion is clear and consistent from room to room. In recent years, commercial control room design has been dominated by several fashions, which have been more or less time sequential. These have all been based on less uniform distributions of acoustic treatment. The most recent is the concept of placing the listener in a so-called reflection-free zone, actually a region of the room where reflection amplitudes are rather less than they would have been otherwise. The underlying principle is the use of redirection and diffusion to reduce the reflection amplitudes in the vicinity of the listener. By this means, it is possible, in principle, to both improve the stereo image sharpness and make the stereo effect independent of the room. Because the key factor in achieving this is the use of non-absorbing surfaces, a dead acoustic is not an inevitable consequence, and indeed, the acoustician has considerable freedom in the choice of reverberation time. This removes the oppressive feeling and makes communication within the room easier and more comfortable. Also, the control room more closely approaches the listener's room conditions. The controlled reflection zone in the control room is achieved by building curves or multiple angled sections into the front wall and the front part of the side walls and ceiling. A project was started in December 1990 at Research Department to find out whether this approach had any real acoustic or other benefits, and if so, to study ways of achieving the results at reasonable cost, both financial and in terms of the potentially wasted room volume. A prototype room was constructed in the acoustic test room at BBC Kingswood Warren using simple timber-framed plasterboard-covered surfaces. The first results from this room were very promising, and after the installation of enough acoustic treatment to reduce the overall reverberation time to around 0.5 second, was demonstrated to and assessed by users' representatives, architects, and managers. Their reactions were generally favourable, sufficiently so to encourage further tests and development. One question raised was the preferred value of overall reverberation time. At about 0.5 second, it was long enough to affect the perceived sound quality, although arguably still representative of the listener's environment. There was also considerable interest from architects and project leaders in the aesthetic implications of these newer designs. In saving large amounts of acoustic treatment, it is likely that such designs could be competitive in terms of cost with those of the present time. The angled reflecting surfaces may also have other benefits. In the past, glazed surfaces, such as observation windows, have been tolerated out of necessity, despite their generally detrimental acoustic properties. With a controlled reflection design, any of these surfaces may be windows, cupboards, or doors. Much of the paraphernalia associated with a modern control room, for example, clock patrices, indicator lights, computer monitors, may be hidden behind glass panels, thereby tidying up both the acoustic and the aesthetic aspects of the room. The surfaces must of necessity be hard and may therefore be more serviceable, longer lasting, and easier to keep clean. It is also likely that they will be intrinsically more fire-resistant than many of the treatments currently employed. The completed test room was eventually assessed by a number of Group 5 studio managers with the possible object of using the design principles in the basement of London Broadcasting House for the refurbishment of some control cubicles. Two different reverberation times were tested, 0.5 and 0.35 seconds. The reactions of these studio managers was generally very favourable, with a significant preference for the shorter reverberation time. The decision was then made by Network Radio to use the design for the cubicles of B12, B13 and B14. The design presents a new challenge for interior designers, namely to coordinate the acoustic and aesthetic requirements with other physical requirements, such as ventilation, technical equipment layout, etc. One immediate benefit is the additional potential for observation windows. B13 and B14 will have two windows totalling nearly 3 metres in width, instead of the single 1.5 metre wide window previously provided. This will permit better sight lines from both the operators and the producers' positions. New design principles for broadcast control rooms, described by Bob Walker of BBC Research Department.
Every day I spend my time drinking wine, feeling fine, waiting here to find the sign that I can understand. Yes, I am. In the days between the hours, ivory towers, bloody flowers, push their heads into the air. I don't care if I ever know. There I go. Before my eyes, paper cries, telling lies. The promises you gave from the grave of a broken heart. Every day I spend my time drinking wine, feeling fine, waiting here to find the sign that I can understand. Yes, I am. Thank you.
You're listening to Sparks every Monday and Tuesday, the programme of science, technical and media news from Britain's number two shortwave station. And let's have a look now at the wave, which has come through the letterbox. This is the July 1992 edition, number two. It's good to see that number two would ever exist. I was sceptical, but it's good to see, and it's got 75p on the cover, even though inside it says the wave is free. The address is the wave, care of 51 St Mark's Road, Canvey Island in Essex, SS89NJ, and they ask for donations, but presumably if you send 75p they'll send you a copy. On the front cover, Euronet lead the way. Information about the Christopher England Caroline offshoot group, which are testing on the Astra Sky Sports transponder subcarrier 7.56 megahertz. Also, Radio Nova to return. Can't see why anyone should want to get excited about that. Run by Keith Lewis now, and the outrageous off the record being sunk by the DTI. Haven't forgotten about that. Hope the shortwave magazine come back in force. And on the back page, something about the Channel 5 television farce. The forthcoming UK terrestrial station Channel 5, expected on air next year, is set to be one of the biggest disasters in British broadcasting history. Its frequency allocation of on and around Channel 36 has to be the most idiotic imaginable, and was apparently derived by computer analysis as being the best available. It just shows how bad the frequencies available were, I think. Channel 36 has been used for well over a decade by VCRs, games machines, computers and satellite receivers. Whoever wins the Channel 5 franchise will be obligated to retune all such apparatus which is interfered with by the broadcasts. With some early equipment, this will prove difficult and very time-consuming to achieve. In many instances, tire satisfactory results will just not be obtained, especially if a VCR and satellite receiver are in use. I have a VCR and two satellite receivers, and there isn't really enough room for the second receiver. If the modulators used were vestigial sideband rather than double sideband, it'd be okay, but they're not. Connections via SCART sockets are one answer, but not always possible or practical. Now, imagine if someone ran a pirate TV station on Channel 36, causing subsequent interference to those watching their VCR or satellite receiver. The radio authority would go berserk, of course, saying how irresponsible it was, what a heinous crime, and no doubt spout the usual nonsense about endangering life by interfering with airport radar. Yet Channel 5 will come on air and will be allowed to disrupt people's viewing while their staff trundle around to every household adjusting every piece of affected equipment. Equally unbelievable is the decision to transmit the signal vertically, the opposite polarity to the existing standard. This is to minimise co-channel interference to foreign stations. Thus most viewers will have to erect another antenna, probably beaming in a different direction to the present one, and every time they watch Channel 5 they will have to change over the antenna. Of course, two antennae can be coupled together, but this can create real problems such as multipath reception, ghosting, and phase cancellation. The obvious answer to this nightmare scenario is for Channel 5 to lease a transponder on Astra 1B instead. RTL, who were interested in bidding for the licence, decided this was the only practical way forward. Ironically, it looks like all those UHF airport radar notch filters will be pressed into service, but this time retuned to eliminate Channel 5. Well, I think those of us who don't have two satellite receivers, not even a single one, well, I lie slightly, there will be that much in a problem, but I can see his position. And also interestingly, in this copy of The Wave, is some details on how you can modify your Ferguson BSB receiver, which you may have been unlucky or unfortunate or stupid enough to buy new, or else you got cheap for about 50 quid, can be turned into a D2 Mac receiver to pick up lots of naughty French stations coming from, where is it, not 31 degree west is BSB, 19 degrees west. And you can contact the company that sell EEPROMs for them, which are Track Satellite Systems, Commerce Way, Skipper's Lane, Middlesbrough, Cleveland, TS66UR. And what they do is you slot in a new EEPROM which is a little programmable microchip, in case you don't know, and you can then watch D2Mac from your DMac receiver, or else you can buy one which switches over between the two standards. And for details of that, write to Track Satellite Systems, Commerce Way, Skipper's Lane, Middlesbrough, in Cleveland, TS6-6UR. That's quite an interesting article. Incidentally, I said I lied about not having a satellite receiver just a while ago. I got a Philips BSB receiver for £20 at a car boot sale. I thought I'd got to get that. Might be come in handy sometime. Now, does anyone know if there is a company that either sells EEPROMs or has any details about converting these to D2Mac? Because otherwise I'm going to have to send off for the chipset details and it could take me years, probably not bother. Anyway, the Wave, that's a rather interesting little pamphlet, 75p. Or send donations if you're feeling rich. To care of 51 St Mark's Road, Canvey Island, Essex, SS89NJ. There's lots of other satellite news and so on in there.
Radio 3 ditches a flagship show to boost ratings by Paul Donovan and Ian Birrell in the Sunday Times. Radio 3 has dropped Music Weekly, one of its flagship programmes, in a move down market that has been condemned by listeners and musicians. The BBC magazine series made its last broadcast on July the 12th, ending a 17-year run that has made tuning into it a Sunday morning ritual for many in the arts world. It will be replaced by a three-hour show playing popular classics aimed at a younger audience. The decision has heightened fears that the traditionally highbrow Radio 3 is becoming too pop in an attempt to compete with Classic FM, the new commercial station to be launched in September. Music Weekly was the BBC's only regular radio programme devoted to news and in-depth analysis of classical and contemporary music. It is one of a series of scheduling changes ordered by Nicholas Kenyon, the new controller of Radio 3, to attract more listeners. The move is understood to have infuriated John Drummond, his predecessor, who revamped the programme 2 years ago. Kenyon is also dropping Your Concert Choice, the Sunday lunchtime listeners' request spot, first broadcast in 1954. Poet of the Month, which has included readings by Seamus Heaney and Ted Hughes, and Soundings, the fortnightly music documentary. John Julius Norwich, leading writer and broadcaster, has arranged a meeting with Kenyon to discuss his concern for Radio 3's future. Music Weekly is one of the programmes which makes Radio 3 the bastion of excellence it is. This concentration on ratings is ridiculous, he said. Many musicians share his concern. Sir Yehudi Menuhin, the violinist and conductor, said the station had a unique and informative output and should not change to compete with a populist rival. It is a great public service which should look after the loyalties of its current listeners and satisfy the public that it alone can satisfy. Sir Charles Mackerras, musical director of the Welsh National Opera, said the station would debase itself by sacrificing quality at the expense of popularity. What is going to be left for the serious music listener? He asked. Music Weekly was given a new style and format 2 years ago. That move was part of a drive to increase the popularity of the station, which last year received £47 million, nearly a quarter of the BBC's network radio budget, but attracted only 2% of its listeners. Drummond, a former director of the Edinburgh Festival, also tried to increase the audience. Kenyon, formerly music critic of The Observer, became controller 3 months ago and pledged to increase audiences still further. He is making a third of the announcers redundant, sent producers to study the presentation of classical stations in America, and indicated his intention to introduce two daily drive-time shows with shorter music sequences. Joanna McGregor, the young pianist and composer, welcomed Kenyon's attempts to overhaul Radio 3. It needs a good shake-up. The music it plays is good and its commissioning policy is excellent, but it needs better scheduling to shake off the dust and become more lively and less BBC. However, she said that Music Weekly had become one of the station's spikiest shows since its relaunch. There is no other general programme like it. These are popular shows he is getting rid of, and there will be a lot of complaints, she said. That report's from the Sunday Times.
America's latest box office release, Batman Returns, has opened. And Batman has a new trick up his sleeve. He's talking in digital. Batman Returns is the first film to use what may well become the de facto digital soundtrack standard. Alas, the Empire Leicester Square in London is the only cinema outside the United States equipped with the necessary equipment. Only the select few will hear the technology in all its glory. Dolby, best known for its hi-fi noise reduction systems, has been working on film sound for more than 20 years and on digital sound since the mid-1980s. Getting quality stereo sound into cinemas is a problem. Stereo only really works over a tiny triangular area between the two speakers, known as the hotspot. To overcome this problem, a center speaker and sometimes additional speakers are placed at the front of the cinema, as well as speakers at the rear. The best sound is produced with 70mm film, but this costs up to five times more than standard 35mm. The larger film size uses magnetic material glued onto the already exposed film print, with the sound then recorded on six tracks. As the film is quite stiff, the tape heads have to push against the film surface and quickly wear out. Dolby wanted to improve the sound on 35mm film to digital quality. It also wanted to leave the conventional optical analog soundtrack intact, so film distributors would not need separate prints for digital and analog cinemas. That dual inventory approach has dogged other attempts to introduce digital cinema sound. Dolby overcame the problem by squeezing the digital information into the spaces between the film's sprocket holes. Using hundreds of small black squares between the holes, Dolby achieved a data rate of 320 kilobits per second, still low compared to the 1400 kilobits per second of stereo CD. However, using sophisticated digital recording and compression techniques to reduce the information recorded, the system produces quality, noise-free recordings with a greater range and better frequency response than any other cinema sound system. That's Steve Homer writing in the Financial Times. And a letter now from James Robinson, who's in Birkenhead. I'd say hello to Phil Muir in Shaftesbury, a piano tuner who tipped me off about Sparks some months ago and who told me he'd heard me being mentioned on the show. That's strange. Presumably after he wrote in, because I didn't know about James Robinson before he was listening, obviously. He's in Birkenhead, and thanks for writing in. And Russell King is in Stansted Abbots in Ware, Hertfordshire. I discovered you while looking for Waveguide on BBC World Service and became hooked. The last I heard of one of the Radio Caroline boats, there were, I believe, Caroline North and Caroline South, was on a TV documentary showing it beached in a river estuary in Africa while its transmitters were being used temporarily until the local government transmitter was set up. Did you see it? No. What on earth? Very strange. Thanks, Russell King. He says, unfortunately, he has no 813s. And he's got a hint saying, I sometimes get clearer reception if I select upper sideband or lower sideband on my FRG7. Well, if you do have any 813 valves, it doesn't matter if you don't know if they're working or not, wrap them up well and send them to us. We'll test them out, send the cost of your postage back to you, and if the valves are any good, they'll get pressed into service until they finally peg out. This week on Sparks, Project Galaxy is announced, but what the hell is it? Two ILR stations in the red, a look at the latest issue of the underground radio magazine The Wave, the British Rail DJ on Caroline, how the outcome of the battle between DCC and Minidisc may lie in the hands of the computer industry, acoustic design of radio control rooms, affordable video conferencing, and cell phones hit the high street, as well as your letters and lots more radio news. Sparks on Radio Fax 3910 6205 and 12255.
Hello. That's my style. Surprise, surprise. So you rub your eyes. Never knew you to yes, so cool as eyes. Hit a bike then, there was stupefy. Ducks categorize us as hard cries. That's a lie, we know why we're occupiers. No blurs but obscure style and these are higher. Profiles are low as soon as we go. As a priest straight from a deeper shade of soul.
Connects with rhythm, the rhythm. Shade of soul. Yeah, yeah.
killing of the sacred cows. You have been appointed the Commissioner for Factual Programmes in the new ITV Central Network team. Your brief is to deliver 1.5 hours a week of current affairs, 1 hour a week of documentaries, and 45 minutes a week of arts programmes. On your first day in the office, you find your desk piled high with enough programme proposals from independent producers to fill these slots 50 times over. There's a note from one of your bosses, the new ITV chief executive, Greg Grade, telling you that his bosses, the 15 managing directors of the ITV companies, are pretty keen to see all their old favourites continue. World in Action, First Tuesday, The South Bank Show, Walden. And there's a note from your other boss, the network director, Mike Dyke, which has gone to all his commissioning executives, declaring that the new team has to make its mark immediately, and that he is expecting significant new commissions in each programme area. What do you do? Resign immediately, perhaps. But if you did stay, you could choose to kill off all the old long-serving series, and none of the ITV managing directors could stop you. Under the terms of the new network agreements, the network board, composed of the ITV managing directors and the central network executives, cannot interfere with specific programme commissions. The possibility of all these famous landmarks disappearing next year is only just beginning to dawn on ITV executives and programme makers. Hitherto, the debate has been about whether the weekday current affairs shows can retain their peak time slots. These long-running series have been protected by the output guarantees enjoyed by the big companies that make them, Granada, Yorkshire and LWT. The other member of this privileged family, this week, disappears when Thames hands over to Carlton at the end of the year. No such guarantees exist under the new system being installed this summer. The network director and his or her team of commissioning executives must select programmes on price and merit. Successful commercial programmes have little to fear under the new regime. It is almost inconceivable that the new team will not want further series of Coronation Street, The Bill or London's Burning. They will be anxious to improve ITV's competitive performance and will grab any bankers. The factual series do not have this kind of asset, though it has been interesting to see World in Action's push for ratings over the past year. They have their record and reputation, however. Why shouldn't this be enough? Or, if it isn't, perhaps this means they shouldn't survive anyway. This sounds reasonable. Unfortunately, a glance at the history of Channel 4 suggests a new commissioning executive might make decisions on criteria other than reputation and record. New Channel 4 commissioning editors have regularly shown a predilection for scrapping their predecessors' commissions and entering into new ones of their own, often when it was not evident that the existing series had anything wrong with it. Such attitudes are understandable when you are a youngish programme maker anxious to further your career. There isn't much glory in simply being a custodian for series created by someone else. And this kind of churn doesn't matter much to Channel 4, since its personality derives in part from a modest quotient of permanent revolution. If the ITV factual commissioner approaches the job in a similar fashion, he or she won't much like the prospect of simply continuing with all the existing series, which take up nearly two-thirds of the available time slots. Does it matter if some sacred cows are therefore slaughtered? There is good reason to approach even a selective culling with caution, because of the potential effect on ITV's image with viewers. For a mainstream television channel, branding depends to a considerable extent on long-running series. And after Coronation Street and News at 10, the factual series would be high on the list of programmes most readily associated with ITV. Furthermore, They represent ITV on its most difficult and vulnerable front, the so-called minority strands. The strands themselves are not at risk, since all the ITV companies, old and new, signed up for them in their new licences. But ITV has, in my view, a commercial reason over and above its contractual obligations for wanting to maximise the value of these programmes. They give the channel a wider appeal, a distinctive quality, which will be vital in the coming battles with channels 4 and 5 and the satellites, and for the advertisers' money. This distinctive appeal could be seriously diminished if any of the ITV institutions is closed down. There is no guarantee a replacement will succeed, and even if it does, it will take years to achieve the reputation of its predecessor. In the meantime, the brand suffers. LWT's recent experience illustrates the problems of tampering with a TV institution. In 1988, after 16 years of lunchtime pontification, Weekend World was replaced by Eyewitness. The new series was well-resourced, ably led, and produced some fresh, vigorous journalism. Yet it never took, and after 2 years was replaced in its turn with a sort of son of Weekend World, Walden. Walden derives a great deal of its strength from its links with the original programme. No programme should be sacrosanct, but assessing the role and value of the long-running factual series deserves particular care. Perhaps we should hope that the new ITV bosses appoint a wise, mellow veteran as Commissioner of Factual Programmes, a 50-something with sufficient days of glory under his or her belt not to need to prove themselves with a hit list of famous corpses. May the landmarks survive. That's Barry Cox, who's Director of Corporate Affairs at LWT, giving his views on the future of ITV network scheduling in Media Guardian.
The Philips DC777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM/FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard-sized car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reversed. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997, or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
You're listening to Sparks on Radiofax 3910 6205 and 12255. August the 14th, 1992, will see the 25th anniversary of the passing of the British Marine etc. Broadcasting Offences Act, which brought to a close the operation of all but one of British offshore pirate stations that had existed during the 60s. These stations broke the BBC monopoly in the UK and began the gradual process by which the British radio system finally accepted commercial radio. Although offshore radio continued after this date, the Marine etc. Broadcasting Offences Act marked the end of the first generation of development of British offshore radio. So, the Caroline movement, Plan Project Galaxy. For those of you who thought it would be never again be possible for an offshore station to broadcast from our coastline, we've got news for you. The Caroline movement planned to put their new offshore station on the air for 3 days over the weekend between August the 14th and August the 16th. The idea is to recreate the atmosphere that existed during those heady offshore days, and give those of you who enjoy nostalgia the opportunity to wallow in plenty of it. Those of you who missed the excitement of days gone by, here's your chance to find out what it was all about. The idea first came about last year when a good number of people suggested that it was time for another event. Our last major event was the highly successful Olau Line cruise in 1989 to celebrate Caroline's 25th anniversary. I went on that, and great fun it was too. So the proposal is for the vessel to be sailed to its anchorage under its own steam in good time for the service to commence. It's proposed the service will operate 24 hours a day during the weekend, although the service will operate under one call sign. The plan is that personalities from a selection of the offshore stations that have operated over the years will present programmes in the style of the stations they represent, complete with all the nostalgia that goes with this. We're hoping to have a section of advertisers from the various eras involved too. We have plans to recreate these days gone by when a unique broadcasting style came from the North Sea. The ship will be tendered from land, just as the offshore stations were, and you'll also be able to visit the ship and see the DJs on board and look at our radio ship. The station will operate in conjunction with a special land-based convention being held in a comfortable venue, where there will be plenty of action. The target area of the service will be designed to at least serve the area along the waterfront where our special convention is being organised. You will be able to see our radio ship from the waterfront, and you will of course be able to receive the service on your transistor radio. It's intended this will be a family weekend. The idea is there will be as much for the rest of the family to do as there will be for the anoraks of the household. We hope you'll bring your family along with you and enjoy a weekend of fun with us all. There will, of course, be facilities for overnight accommodation. So, sounds like an interesting weekend, and if you'd like details, please drop a stamped addressed envelope to Project Galaxy, 23 Grove Road, Grays in Essex, RM17 6JY. It says please indicate how many places you'd like, whether you might like overnight accommodation, and whether you plan to travel by car or by public transport, and it no way commits you to a booking. That's Project Galaxy, 23 Grove Road, Grays in Essex, RM17 6JY. And they've tried to be very coy about the location, but thanks to the Wave magazine, I can tell you it's going to be around Walton-on-the-Naas. And fingers crossed I should see you there. It's August the 14th to August the 16th. That's the Caroline Movement's Project Galaxy, offshore radio recreated.
You might like to hear this about Radio Caroline's special event license, written by X laser-involved person Paul Rusling in the American magazine World Broadcast News. Famous pirate ship gets license. One of the best-known ship-borne pirate radio stations returned to the air in April, only this time with a license from its adversary of the last 30 years, the British government. Radio Caroline, which began broadcasting in the spring of 1964, has broadcast its mixture of pop music and messages of love and peace, 1960s style, to Western Europe from a variety of ships over the last three decades. But its most recent one was silenced when new legislation was introduced by the British government almost 2 years ago. The ship, a former trawler, remained at sea, but silent until November, when it was torn from its moorings in a storm and swept onto the Goodwin Sands in the English Channel. After a daring rescue of the crew by RAF helicopter, the ship was salvaged and taken into Dover Harbour. The owner has busied himself trying to raise new capital and get a license from a third world nation to allow Radio Caroline to return to sea and resume broadcasting. Meanwhile, the crew of radio engineers and DJs, eager to get back on air, have managed to persuade the UK's radio authority to grant a restricted service special event license to the ship. The basis for this turnaround seems to be the unexpected appearance of the ship in Dover Harbour, something that has attracted many tourists. The station resumed broadcasting with just 25 watts on FM, and had just 1 month to raise money from listeners and advertisers. There has been some success and lots of media coverage, but also Caroline's competitors, including the BBC, have lent publicity and support. The Radio Caroline staff recently split into different camps. Some prefer to continue broadcasting on a satellite television subcarrier. Others are happy with a low-power temporary operation in the UK, while the mainstream group want the ship back at sea with its high-power medium-wave transmitters reaching a wide area once again. Until Radio Caroline, named after the daughter of US President John F. Kennedy, raises sufficient new capital and a license from another country to broadcast from international waters, the only circumstances under which she can return to sea, the ship will put into other ports in England to conduct fundraising efforts. A sorry state for a station which 20 years ago had millions of listeners across Europe. Paul Rusling, writing there in the American World Broadcast News.
And more of him in a moment. Thanks to Ron Prosser, he's sent me the Communication Magazine, which is the monthly journal of the British DX Club, and very thick it is too. Inside, Alan Muster has some hints on picking up FM DX. The wonderful thing is that the band is stable, and therefore any abnormality is easily noticed. If you have a signal strength meter, then certain stations which are normally there but weak are likely to show a signal improvement, which is a key indicator that something funny is going on and worth tuning around to discover how unusual conditions are. This for me is the pleasure of FMDX. It's rare enough to be special. There's always a surprise awaiting. After years of FMDXing, I was impressed by the quality of the opening on the 10th to the 14th of June. I live in Ilford and receive a good strong signal from Melody Radio on 104.9 MHz. Yet despite this powerful signal, I was able to hear BBC Radio Leicester by holding my portable radio in a null position. For those of you who don't know, Ilford is in East London, 90 miles away, making this amazing DX. It didn't stop there. Radio Trent and BBC Radio WM in the Midlands, all the way across the countryside of England, to Radio Solent in the south, Radio Bristol in the west, and SGR FM, formerly Radio Orwell in Ipswich, could all be heard in London. Truly amazing. And he lists some other stations. Now, this Communication Magazine is rather a good one. On the next page, there's a whole page of DX programmes which you can listen to, including our own. And some international news, including Radio Bosnia-Herzegovina has started newscasts in English. They're at approximately 1800 and 2210 GMT. The main frequency is medium wave 612 kHz. The short news broadcast in English from Sarajevo has been heard by John Stewart at around 2215 on 612 kHz. The station identifies as Radio Bosnia-Herzegovina, but unfortunately there are about four other stations coming in at John's location at the same time, which makes it hard to follow what's being said. The main one of them is RTE Athlone in Ireland. However, there are some nights when Sarajevo comes through quite strongly, so it might be possible to catch the English News Bulletin. Also, looking through, Lithuania Weekly reports on plans for a 24-hour English language commercial station by UK-based Iconi Radio. Jonathan Marks investigated at Company's House in London and discovered that Iconi Radio director is Paul Rusling, ex of Laser 558, and writer of the article. He's in Lithuania and claims to be installing a 200-kilowatt transmitter. The company's working title is Baltic Radio International. A frequency in the lower portion of the medium wave band is planned, located between Klaipėda and Palanga on the Lithuania coast, with a start date claimed for the beginning of next year. That should come in very well. And also in Eastern Europe, Chinese students leaders behind the Tiananmen Square revolt have visited Hungary to discuss the possibility of launching Radio Free China from there. United States assistance will set the venture up. And Radio Japan conducted tests via the BBC transmitters at Skelton in early June, in preparation for regular relays. Radio Japan's new general service frequencies, effective from the 1st of July, are in Skelton from 5 until 6, 9695 and 9770. 9770 is also on between 700 and 800 in the morning UTC, also on 9670. And from 2300 until midnight on 6025 and 6160. That's the Skelton frequencies. I won't give out the Gabon frequencies because you'll probably find Skelton better to pick up. I've got a comparison tape of those two, which you can listen to.
By the way, morning, or at least, is used referring to something near the speaker. Another word, sorry, what that is used when referring to something near the listener.
That was 11735 from Gabon in Africa, and now 6160 from Skelton in Britain.
We now bring you a commentary. Today's talk on Afghanistan was written by Yoshio Endo, associate professor at Takushoku University. More than a month has passed since an Islamic provisional government was born in Afghanistan following the collapse of the communist regime after 14 years of internal conflict. There are frequent clashes over the leadership of the new government.
Very listenable there, Radio Japan on 6160 kilohertz, and you can hear that in English from 11 o'clock UTC to midnight. And thanks very much to Ralph Bradley for sending that comparison tape in. He lives in South Gosforth in Newcastle upon Tyne. So back to this packed edition of Communication. And in Russia, the expansion of broadcasts by Radio Umo Shinrinki Kyoi, I think it is, the Japanese religious sect, via Radio Moscow World Service. Programmes on all frequencies have been replaced by this station, which I won't read again, in English at 0430 to 0459 and 2030 to 2059 UTC. The broadcasts are not introduced by Radio Moscow, whose programming ends abruptly at 4:30 in the morning and 8:30 at night, resuming again with identifications after the program's finished. The name of the station, which is written again there, is translates as from Greek to as Gospel of the Kingdom. The programs consist of the propagation of the absolute truth of the Holy Heaven, with teachings, spiritual songs, and advertisements for a book by Shohoku Ashihara. An address in Japan is announced. Well, it seems everybody's getting in on the act, and it shows how short of money Radio Moscow are these days. So, looking through this again, lots and lots of news, medium wave, tropical bands, HF. I'm sure I've got some other stuff marked in here. Just to give you an idea of how enormous this thing is. Unfortunately, it's not stapled, which is really my only complaint to the thing. On shortwave news, Dun Loggerhair local radio, which I'm sure you've all heard, is 24 hours locally on 106 megahertz VHF with 250 watts, but only on 6220 kilohertz at weekends with 120 watts due to TV interference problems. They mentioned a move to 9900, 9.9 megahertz, a few weeks ago. This would be in parallel with 6220 with a new 350 watt transmitter. And Radio Dublin has plans to start a separate international shortwave service to include religious programmes. The station also plans to increase power on 6911 from 250 to 1,000 watts. Lots of 813s glowing there. They have an Anorak programme on Saturdays from 1 until 2 in the afternoon and a free radio programme on Friday from 8 until 9. I'll have to listen out for them. That's Radio Dublin 6911. Pity their audio quality is so awful. Did I mark anything else? I don't think I did. So that's in all 40 pages, which seems excellent value every month. And you can join the British DX Club for £9 in the United Kingdom. And for subscriptions, it's Dave Kenny at 10 Hemdene Hill, Caversham, Reading, RG47SB to join the British DX Club. Dave Kenny, 10 Hemdene Hill, Caversham, Reading, RG47SB. Thoroughly recommended that magazine. I hope Ron continues to send it to me because it's a fascinating read. And in comparison, I'm sorry to say, I've got this somewhere, EuroDX, the Journal of the European DX Council, is rather a sorry affair. 7 pages. Not a lot of useful radio news, and, well, I know they're only doing it as a hobby, but I'm sure they can do better. The European DX Council, their address is P.O. Box 4, St. Ives, Huntingdon, Cambridgeshire, England, PE 17 4FE. That's the European DX Council. P.O. Box 4, St. Ives, Huntingdon, Cambridgeshire, England, PE 17 4FE. A couple of issues here. which you'd need about, how many, five of these issues to make up one British DX Club issue. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts, and here's some more Irish radio news. The Communications Minister, Marie Goghan Quinn, is to introduce a review of the 1990 Broadcast Act this autumn, but she still has to decide whether the proposals will be in the form of a new bill or as amendments to the existing Act. Whichever is quicker and avoids delay, she said, speaking last week at the launch of an independent radio sales body set up to market local radio stations to advertising agencies. She has still to involve Irish state broadcaster RTE in the discussions, but she's received submissions from independent producers, local radio advertisers and advertising agencies. I'll have to get Trevor to send off some proposals to them. I expect you can guess what he's going to say. We'd like an independent shortwave radio licence, please. We're also campaigning for that in this country, and you can write to your MP saying, why should the BBC World Service have all the fun? We'd like to do a bit of shortwave broadcasting ourselves, or to do it legally from Britain at least. And if you send the letter that you receive back to us, we'll read it out, providing it's not too boring, which it probably will be, but we'll give you a mention anyway and read your letter out.
Not okay.
Fine Electronics World News, Yunko Yoshida reports the future for digital compact cassette and mini disc could be computers. The fate of the two competing digital audio formats may lie in the hands of the computer industry, not the audio or record industries. Clearly, the minidisc is going to become much more than just a digital audio medium, said Toshihiko Sugiura, Deputy Division Manager of the Optical Technology Division at Sanyo Electric. It'll evolve into an audio, video, and computer storage device. Sony, the developer of minidiscs, has never publicly outlined the future of its new recordable digital disc, other than as a portable digital audio disc to replace analog compact cassettes. We've developed mini discs to offer portability of tapes, reliability, and random access capability of compact discs, said Norio Oka, Sony's president. The computer industry, however, is quietly showing an increasing interest in mini discs. As some emerging products become smaller in size, more audiovisual oriented, and geared for personal use. Sanyo's Sugiura says, executives from Apple Computer are visiting us here tomorrow to look at Intar mini disc pickup technologies. The 220 megabyte mini disc, equipped with an overwrite capability, has every reason to appeal not only to consumer electronics manufacturers, but to toy companies and computer manufacturers as well, he added. Both digital compact cassette and minidisc systems depend on highly sophisticated components, such as laser pickups for magneto-optical discs and thin film heads for digital tapes, originally used in computer peripheral equipment. There are several challenges in transferring such an industrial-use technology to a consumer-use mass production level. Redesigning them in a smaller package, offering them at a cheaper price, and improving yield and reliability as a mass product. Mini discs, for example, require a dual-function pickup. They're based on the conventional CD player laser pickup, but modified to contain a polarized beam splitter to detect magneto-optical playback signals. Optical parts alone that are required for a mini disc pickup amount to 9, three times a regular CD pickup. The difficulty is not just tripled, but the cube of 3, said the Sanyo engineer. And despite denials by Philips and Matsushita, there has been a continued scepticism among Japanese consumer electronics makers about manufacturability of thin film heads and digital compact cassette systems. An industry source pointed out that two companies are not making their initial DCC products for the world market at their own plants. Both have asked Philips' Tokyo-based subsidiary Marantz Japan to mass-produce them. The decision to produce Philips' first worldwide DCC product in Japan was just a matter of allocating resources, said a Philips spokesman based in Eindhoven in the Netherlands. That was by Linda Bernier and Yunko Yoshida in Electronics World News. And in the Financial Times, Paul Taylor reports video conferencing is a technology and business communication medium whose time may finally have arrived. Equipment prices are falling, simple-to-use desktop and PC card systems are appearing, and for the first time, video conferencing and video telephony are beginning to offer a real alternative to costly, inconvenient, and tiring travel. Several factors are driving the recent rapid growth. Firstly, the cost of equipment has fallen dramatically, from about £200,000 in 1986 to around £20,000 in mid-1991. According to PictureTel's UK subsidiary, prices are roughly halving every 2 years. These falling costs have been made possible by the availability of very large-scale integration IC codecs, the advanced integrated circuits used in systems to digitise and compress the picture. Secondly, the availability of dial-up high-speed data connections, like Mercury's switched-band 64 kilobit per second dial-up bandwidth on demand service launched last autumn, means that users are charged on the basis of bandwidth only, instead of having to own or lease expensive data connections which are not used all of the time. Companies can now dial up the capacity as they require, without pre-booking it as and when they want it. In the UK, inland video calls can cost as little as £15 an hour, cheaper than a taxi from Heathrow to central London. And a transatlantic call costs around £160 an hour. In the United States, costs are even lower, with a coast-to-coast call costing between $15 and $20 an hour. Also, technical improvements have resulted in higher quality sound and pictures over lower levels of bandwidth. Old systems used to produce jerky images on 2 megabit lines, while today's systems produce much more acceptable video on 128 kilobit per second lines. While falling equipment and usage charges make video conferencing affordable to more organisations, a growing awareness of other issues like the time and cost of travelling and its impact on the environment are also adding to its attractions. This means that video conferencing is no longer just a boardroom novelty, but is also being used by geographically dispersed project and sales teams, consultants, specialists, and others at executive and middle management level. And also Adrian Morant writes, audio conferencing has been available for many years, but 1992 marks a turning point in terms of the technology. According to Steve Gandy, marketing manager of sales at BT Visual and Broadcast Services, in fact, things have started changing quite radically. The key change has been the introduction of low-cost audio conferencing equipment, which is purpose-built for the conferencing environment, enabling a number of people to participate no matter where they're located. More importantly, the new generation of systems feature full duplex operation and the latest echo-cancelling technology, which means that everyone in the room and people in remote locations can all speak at the same time and be heard by each other as if they were in the same room, with no clipped sentences or lost meanings, he says. And one application of this mentioned might be telephone broadcasting, using the telephone system like a radio transmitter to send a message to the whole workforce simultaneously. The broadcast can be turned into a phone-in program, allowing key regional managers to quiz the boss on an important policy issue. Audio conferencing is being used for crisis management in commercial operations. The AA and RAC are big users for control of traffic and general operations. It's also used in the professions, such as law and management consultancy, where time is money and fee earners must be seen to be offering a cost-effective service. A couple of reports from the Financial Times. And hello quickly to Ross Coutts, who's sent a few 813 valves, which we've sent and put into operation. Well, thanks very much for them, Ross.